From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1973. The first description of fetal alcohol syndrome was published that year, and the scientific and medical community increased their efforts to understand the impact of alcohol on a developing fetus. For years, the most common diagnosis was made using physical features: a thin upper lip, a lack of the groove below the nose called a philtrum, narrow eyes, small head. Those have always been telltale signs. But it's really only been in the last 10 or 15 years that the outlook has broadened in regards to the impact of alcohol during pregnancy. We now hear the term FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. 40 years ago, the number of children born with fetal alcohol syndrome seemed relatively small. Today, some researchers believe 2 to 5% of children, maybe sitting in an elementary school classroom right now, are living with FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And it's not always marked by the physical features. It's not always marked by lower intelligence. That can make it very difficult for schools to understand it and to deal properly with children living with FASD. So this hour, we go inside the research and the approach to dealing with it. Today happens to be International FASD Awareness Day. We're going to answer some of your questions as well this hour, and let me introduce my guests. Christy Petrenko is a research psychologist at the Mount Hope Family Center, and Christy, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you, Evan.
Lynn Cole is here, the director of the Kurtz Developmental Services Center, and Lynn, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, already this morning on Twitter, where we are in communication with our listeners at all hours of the day, they were asking, wait, what's the difference between FAS and FASD? And I'm sure you hear that eventually. Is FAS, is that a term that we hear a lot less of these days? Is it FASD now? How do we define it? Christy?
Well, FASD is the broader spectrum, and there's a number of specific diagnostic categories within that spectrum. But there are four specific things that we look at across all of the diagnoses, and that includes we look for facial features that you already identified. We look at growth. We look at the impact on the brain, and then we look at confirmed alcohol exposure. And so fetal alcohol syndrome has all of those characteristics: the facial features, the growth, the brain effects, and confirmed alcohol exposure. There are other diagnoses that only have the brain effects without the growth in the face.
And we're going to talk about that this hour because, you know, I think it's easy for parents who are not researching this to think, well, if intelligence is not markedly different, et cetera, then maybe there is no impact. But we'll be talking about that this hour. Mark on Twitter, one of our listeners, asked this morning, I hear spectrum, I think autism. Is this the same kind of approach to understanding it? Is that fair, Christy and Lynn?
Absolutely. There's a number of disorders that have been recognized as being more of a spectrum rather than a distinct diagnosis with a beginning point and end point. So kind of like autism spectrum disorders, where there is where children or adults who are affected have a range of abilities and disabilities. Children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders can also have a range of abilities and disabilities.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments on these issues, you can call the program this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It's at Evan Dawson on Twitter, where a lot of you have already weighed in this morning. We'll be getting to some of your comments there. You can also always email the program. You can find it through our website at wxxinews.org/connections. And now the question, let's start right with that number. I mentioned 2 to 5%. And I think, depending on where you sit, that sounds like a lot or a little. To me, it sounds like a lot. 2 to 5 kids sitting in a classroom right now in Rochester might have FASD. And Christy Petrenko, I think if that's 1 out of 20 children, that's a kid in almost every class who's dealing with this, mm-hmm. living with this, and maybe the teacher knows or maybe doesn't and understand it. What does that number say to you? Does that sound like a lot or a little to you?
It does sound like quite a lot to me, and the most astounding part for me is very few of those kids will actually ever be recognized and formally diagnosed. So many of those kids will just experience their life of often feeling like a failure or stupid, and people misunderstanding their behavior as being purposeful or willful, when often there's underlying brain reasons why they're struggling.
Lynn Cole, what does that number sound like to you?
It also sounds like a lot to me. You know, the majority of children that we see in our clinical services are children who are either in foster care, family care, adoptive care. But what we know is that there are more children out there who are living with biologic families, and that the stigma is really prevents children from getting accurate diagnoses.
Okay. A lot of different ways to go with this, but I want to talk about what Lynn and Christy do here, because when it comes to diagnostic clinics, my understanding is we still don't see a lot of this, but let's talk about what we do. So, Lynn, at the Kurtz Developmental Services Center, what is it that you do in relation to FASD?
We do a number of things. So Christy and I have been working together over the last couple years to really develop a more systematic process for diagnosing children with FASD. We see a lot of children through our general clinical services and developmental and behavioral pediatrics who are able to identify, especially those kids who have facial features. The work that Christy and I have been doing together is really to work with those children who are a little bit older and who may not have as obvious features and who require much more careful examination of their neurologic functioning in order to establish a diagnosis.
And what's older?
In the kind of 6 through 15 age range is most of the children that we're seeing. And then we've also been working to establish a greater system of supports for families in our community.
Okay.
Including some behavioral supports and some parenting supports.
And I think we're going to work through this because, as our guests have identified, a big problem is the fact that kids who may have FASD don't know it. Their families may not know it. But once you do get that diagnosis, the question is, you know, what does that mean? What do you do about it? So we're going to be working towards that. But let's talk about diagnosing first, because I certainly would want to make sure my understanding is that you can really zero in on alcohol. Unfortunately, a lot of people who drink heavily during pregnancy or drink heavily routinely may have other challenges. They may not have a very good diet of nutrition. They may smoke or be on other drugs. So how do you start to kind of drill down and say, what we think is impacting this child is FASD, that it wasn't something else? Let me start with Christy. How do you start to answer that question?
That is one of the biggest challenges in diagnosis, is getting getting information about the prenatal alcohol exposure. Measuring the face, testing, neuropsych testing are pretty straightforward. But oftentimes we have to help coach families to find out where we can get that information, if it's available. Unfortunately, not a lot of medical providers are documenting in the child's birth records if they've been exposed. They may not be asking all the right questions. Sometimes we'll be able to get collateral information from biological relatives. Some adoptive families may still have contact, and we'll be able to get at least some reasonable background information that we can
collateral,
confirm.
Just anecdotal information?
Being that maybe maternal grandmother witnessed her daughter drinking during pregnancy, or would go over to the house to help with other children, and there would be beer all over the place, and which she would be hungover. Things like that, for example, would be what we could count. Also, if we know that the mother was in treatment during the time of her pregnancy at some point, that can be helpful to document. But many times, for some families, they just don't have any records or any ability to access. So that's a limitation for them.
And what if a parent or someone, a relative of a child says, well, so what? Mom was drinking during pregnancy, but mom was also smoking and mom was doing other things, and you're not going to be able to pin it on alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that?
Well, you are correct. There is no way to definitively say this is for sure alcohol. So most of our diagnostic terms will say, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder or prenatal or neurobehavioral disorder associated with alcohol, for example. So it's not definitively saying this is for sure alcohol, but we have a lot of evidence from basic and animal research as well, where you can control all of those factors such as nutrition and genetics. And there is really definitive effects that it is the alcohol affecting that. So we then believe that alcohol likely had a role.
So we're starting to see that alcohol does have specific possible impacts on a developing brain, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to kind of even eliminate some of the other variables and say, this is, you bring alcohol into the equation, and this can happen. Is that fair?
Oh, the animal and molecular research is very clear that it is alcohol affecting the brain to the level of neurons and how it affects the DNA and all of that.
Okay. And so, Lynn, most of the families that you are working with come to you why specifically?
Most,
and I don't know if there is a most on this, but...
I, w- Yeah, there is a most. Okay. I would say most of them come with a combination of behavior and learning concerns. So most families who come are struggling with some significant behavioral challenges, and a child may be doing kind of so-so at school. And so they really come looking for advice on, you know, why are the typical parenting strategies not working? Why is my child struggling so much? And what can I do to help with that?
They don't walk in the door thinking, hey, is this FASD? They're thinking, there's a problem and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. Most of the time?
Most of the time. Occasionally families are questioning FASD, but it really in many instances comes out as we start to ask about all of the factors that may contribute to these kinds of challenging behaviors.
Okay. If you're just joining us, it's International Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day. And we're talking to two guests who are very involved in not only working on this problem, but working on solutions. It's Lynn Cole, the director of the Kirch Developmental Services Center, and Christy Petrenko, a research psychologist with the Mount Hope Family Center. And it's not just, again, that sort of lower intelligence, et cetera. It sounds like, and Christy, let's start to kind of work through this. If 30 years ago, we would have just looked for those physical features and then been concerned about it. A child could come in with a typical-looking philtrum, upper lip, eye size, head size, and still have FASD, yes?
In order to be on the full FASD somewhere along the spectrum, yes, you can have no facial features, normal-sized head, normal-sized body, and have significant learning and behavioral challenges.
And it's not just a lower intelligence from FASD.
No, I've tested many children who actually are in the average range or even above average, but they have significant difficulties in other areas like memory, learning, executive functioning, social communication are some really common areas that they struggle with.
So when we talk about executive function, can you define that
a
little bit more?
Yes, I like to think of executive functioning more of if you think of like a CEO of an office. A CEO is someone that really brings together, plans, organizes. That's the kind of function in your brain that we're thinking of, the part that's really involved in multiple step instructions, inhibiting behavior, organizing and planning. That's an area that's a really significant struggle for many people with FASD.
So a child may be intelligent, above average intelligence, but have impulsive moments, bad decision making, things like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once you start to kind of identify that, what are the steps that you and Lynn are going to take to say, okay, this child has these issues, but let's take some steps to figure out. Is it going back through family history, interviewing, I guess relying on memory during pregnancy, other things? What are some of the steps?
We really do a fairly comprehensive evaluation. So we start with exactly what you're talking about, looking at the history. So looking at prenatal care, history of prenatal exposures, whether there might be other factors that could that may have happened during that prenatal period. Next, we also talk with the family about what happened with the child after he or she was born. Were there any birth problems? So we're really looking at all of the things that can contribute to developmental challenges in addition to the alcohol. We talk a lot about environment, where did the child live, who took care of him or her. And so we look at all of those prenatal things. Then we do some review of the child's school testing. So most children will have gone through either early intervention, preschool, or the Committee for Special Education, and we'll begin to look at their school records and find out how things have been going in school and what standardized testing says about their development in a variety of areas. Next, if they have symptoms that are suggestive of a fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, we will bring them into our clinical program, where for some children we will do additional neuropsychological testing depending on what has already been done, and we'll also do physical exam and facial measurements and growth measurements. And then we really pull all of that information together and try to sort out, is the pattern something that looks consistent with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or does it look like something else? There's a lot of other things that children can present with similar behaviors, and we really want to sort out, is this a pattern of behaviors and physical features and history that are consistent with the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or would we call it something else?
What does a diagnosis actually mean then for the family and for that child?
So it means a number of things. So first, it for many families helps them to understand their child, where he or she is coming from, and where some of these behavioral challenges and learning challenges are coming from. So for many families, just having that understanding that this is a brain-based problem and not a child being willfully difficult or willfully misbehaving, and that they truly have brain-based difficulties, can be very helpful just for family coping and family approach to working with their child. The other thing it does is it helps the other people who are working with the child, whether that is the school psychologist, a community therapist, or the child's school team, to understand what are this child's strengths and weaknesses. So many children present very well because they have strong expressive language skills, and so they present as friendly and social and bright. And so some of the challenges can be more hidden, and so it can make people feel like the child is not trying hard enough or is being difficult. And so helping people understand that some of those difficulties are really, the child is trying, can be really helpful just in their approach.
How are our schools doing at dealing with this? That's a big, broad question that doesn't have a singular answer, but how are we doing in schools from the teaching level, administratively, to working with kids who have FASD?
I think one of the main challenges is that most teachers don't receive training or education on FASD as part of their training. But most teachers that I've worked with in the capacity of consulting with them in the school about a specific child are very receptive, and they really want to do the best for the child. But oftentimes that means providing them accurate information about FASD and collaboratively working with them to come up with specific strategies that are going to meet the child's needs in the most effective way possible.
This is a hard one, I would think, Christy, because I would think, from what you're telling us, FASD manifests and impacts each individual child differently. So, you know, each individual teacher is going to have to, first of all, understand that there is a diagnosis, that it is a real thing, and that it may mean different things for different kids. I mean, that's a lot of work. So how do we start to move it towards, you know, more sort of broadly dealing with that?
Well, and I think you're right. I hear some people say, if you know one child with FASD, you know one child with FASD. And I think that's true of most developmental disabilities and other things. But I think the biggest thing for that would be useful for teachers is to, one, just know what FASD is, and then understand this concept that we call reframing, which is really understanding the child's behavior from the perspective of having brain-based disabilities rather than willfully trying to be disobedient. And once teachers grasp that concept, they automatically transition into creative problem solving and coming up with accommodations that work. It's once they can kind of change their perspective.
You've seen a lot of progress when you actually have that conversation. Yeah, teachers, I think, can be very creative, as you say. And Lynn, you're nodding over there, but I'm thinking of all the different classrooms that this could impact children in. And, you know, I guess it starts maybe a higher need, more acute need in the city and impoverished areas, but I don't know. Is that a stereotype that I shouldn't make?
I think that may be a bit of a stereotype. Mm-hmm. Actually, if we look at our recent clinical population, many of them actually come from rural and outlying areas. So, you know, alcohol is legal in our country, and so it is a substance that's used and misused across all socioeconomic statuses. And so this is not an exclusively city problem, and we see children who are affected in rural areas, in the suburbs, and in the cities. And I think, you know, it's so we need to attend to it in all areas. My experience has really been that the vast majority of teachers that our kids and families work with are fabulous and really are working hard for this group of kids. They can be challenging. Most parents won't deny that, but we have a lot of really, we're really lucky in our community to have a lot of really compassionate and caring teachers who are really willing to be creative.
And let me ask a question from sort of a psychological perspective, because we hear from so many different parents whose children are dealing and living with different things, autism, so many others, and sometimes that diagnosis, as frightening as it can be a relief because it offers you some idea or explanation that would help you understand why is this behavior this way, et cetera. But FASD may come And I don't want to project here, but with a little bit of a harder acceptance because there could be some guilt associated, that it was sort of a parental action during pregnancy. And do you find any resistance for the parents? Because then the parent's going to have to decide, how do I help my child? Do I talk to a teacher? You know, what do I do? Do you encounter any resistance based on saying, well, don't blame me, that can't be what it is? Do you find that, Christy?
Many of the families we work with are foster, adoptive, or relatives who don't have that same level of guilt. But I have worked with a number of biological mothers. And I think as long as professionals come at it in a very non-judgmental, supportive manner, I think many biological parents can come to a place where they really accept that diagnosis and become really engaged to try to advocate effectively for their child.
Okay. And then so let's kind of zero in on classrooms even a little bit more here, because Christy is saying when you work with teachers, you tend to see good results and progress. But I have to think there's still a good amount of teachers, unless I'm wrong, because you're saying it's not part of regular training.
Well, many of them don't know.
They just don't know.
But as soon as
they
you teach
know.
Them,
right.
they do, I think, well.
So at the very least, how do we get to a point where the average teacher in a classroom is at least aware of FASD in general? Whether it's child by child, that's a different thing. But that awareness should be sort of baked into the training, yes?
I would agree.
Okay. Is there any movement to see that happen?
You know, I have personally, locally, I've done some training and different, you know, across a lot of different programs. Because it's not just teachers. It's physicians. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of mm-hmm. physicians that don't have accurate information about FASD, mental health providers, and any other type of provider. I think it's across the board that professionals just don't have a lot of awareness about FASD as well as the general community. But I, you know, part of the struggle when I've talked with administrators of different education programs or medical programs is that their training requirements are already very full. And trying to convince, you know, and think about the medical school curriculum, trying to get in just to do an hour lecture on FASD was almost impossible.
Okay, but if the average classroom has around at least one student sitting in there with this issue, I know schedule's kind of full. But that becomes a priority, doesn't it?
I would think so.
And Lynn, when it comes to clinics, do I have this right? There's only two diagnostic clinics in the state?
Is that
right?
That I know of, yes.
That
yes.
we know of? Why is that? That's always an interesting question. It's often the question is funding. But is it also still because this is kind of an evolving field even still?
Well, I would say it's a combination of funding, training, and resources. So Christy and I are on a statewide planning group that is looking at both, you know, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of FASDs. So it's a combination of, you know, funding. So this is, you know, the clinic that we are currently running, we are able to run because of grant funding. And that's, you know, not going to last forever. So we are continuing to seek the type of funding that is required for this, because the type of evaluations that these kids require are not often covered by insurance. And many children are have Medicaid, which has a lower reimbursement rate. But there's also skills and capacity. So developmental pediatrics in general is an oversubscribed subspecialty. There just aren't enough developmental pediatricians and psychologists and nurse practitioners in the nation. And so there are a couple small groups, but regardless of your diagnosis, there's a challenge for getting adequate diagnostic evaluations. And then even within that, there is the need for additional training and accurate diagnosis.
Will writes to the program and says, Evan, you asked if 2 to 5% sounds like a lot or a little. I'll answer that question. It sounds like a lot. Are you sure they are not over-diagnosing this issue? They said they're still not sure how many kids actually have it. It's a fair question.
So
how do you come to 2 to 5%?
The 2 to 5% was from a study that took place in the Midwest. And the same methodology has been used in a number of sites around the world by really well-established researchers. And what they do is they go into first grade classrooms within a region, and they get consent, and they do screening of every child. And they then calculate estimates based how many kids that they identify with the different disorders within the spectrum, and determine the rates. And they calculate a range based on the confidence intervals.
Okay, so you feel good about that, obviously.
Yes, and they've repeated the same methodology over and over in different countries and have found similar rates.
Fitz on Twitter says, is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder only caused when a pregnant woman drinks alcohol? And if so, how much causes it? Well, the answer to the first one is yes. It's only caused when there's alcohol intake.
Yes. So if you are a person with FASD, you cannot pass it to your child unless you actively drink during your pregnancy.
And then his next question is, how much causes it?
Yes. Okay. This is the question we get all the time. So there's pretty clear evidence that binge drinking styles and heavy consumption of alcohol cause fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. There is support, particularly in animal studies, as well as some human studies, although it's a bit more mixed with humans, about moderate levels. So a drink per day on average would be considered moderate drinking. The problem with human research is that, especially when you get lower kind of or moderate levels of alcohol, is that there are so many other factors that influence outcome. You've mentioned nutrition, genetics, definitely how well a woman metabolizes alcohol is influenced by your genetics. And, you know, even your epigenetics. I know that's a big kind of buzzword recently, but just how alcohol directly impacts that. So there's no safe thresholds have been established because...
And probably never will be.
And probably never will be. And the best information I would give advice is if you are currently pregnant or even trying to become pregnant, not to drink. And that if you are drinking, to use effective contraception to not become pregnant.
On that note, I have an email from a listener that came in this morning when we teased the show, and I want to read it after our short break, and we'll get our guest's response to it, because this has, I think, been a sensitive question for a lot of people. And by the way, Fitz, your question is a great one. You know, what is the level? And so we're going to get a little bit more into that when we come back in just a second with Lynn Cole, the director of the Kurtz Developmental Services Center, and Christy Petrenko, research psychologist with the Mount Hope Family Center. You're going to want to hear this email next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it's a wide-ranging Fringe preview. The first Niagara Rochester Fringe Festival is just days away. We run down the events, more than 500 performances, and a huge, huge turnout expected for what has become a great annual tradition. We'll meet the producer, some of the people involved with the planning, and get you all set for the Fringe next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Hochstein School of Music and Dance, welcoming students of all ages to explore music and dance in an environment designed to nurture creativity, offering lessons, group classes, short courses, and ensembles. To learn more, visit hochstein.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's International Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day. And here is an email that came in from a listener named Kara in Pittsburgh this morning. Kara wrote the following, quote, "I can't help but feel somewhat demonized, and it started with my own friends. I didn't know I was pregnant, found out after about 6 weeks. I had been drinking, not binge drinking, normal drinks with dinner during those 6 weeks. When I found out I was pregnant, I was overjoyed at first. We hadn't been trying, but we wanted a baby eventually. Then a friend suggested that I really should consider abortion because of the effect of the alcohol. I explained I had not been drinking heavily, hadn't really been drunk in those 6 weeks. She said it didn't matter. My baby was at risk. My husband freaked out. Our doctor calmed us down and told us we shouldn't panic. He said privately that I was healthy, in shape, I ate well, and he said that most of the concern about alcohol during pregnancy is in regards to heavy drinking. My friend wasn't convinced. She kept pushing me. I felt shamed. I cried a lot. And eventually my friend and I had a falling out. We no longer speak. Meanwhile, we kept the baby. My doctor told me he couldn't say this publicly, but that even half a glass of wine once or twice a week with dinner was really shown to have very little impact or none. He said there's no guaranteed safe level, but that I wasn't endangering anyone with half a glass once in a while. All I'm saying is I don't think I'm alone. I'm not a heavy drinker. I lost a friendship. I almost gave up my baby. Please consider people like me when you have these discussions." That's from Kara in Pittsburgh. What do you make of that?
Absolutely. We wholeheartedly agree. And there's, you know, actually a fairly big push from the National Organization on FASD to really address the perspective and the needs of birth mothers, whether or not the child has FASD. And clearly it sounds like this child probably does not. I feel horrible when those kind of discussions happen between friends and pregnant women. And what we know is that the vast majority of children affected by FASD, their mother either drank prior to knowing that she was pregnant or had an active alcoholism problem and was unable to stop drinking during pregnancy. And so we're very sensitive to those issues, and we certainly don't want to demonize women who are really looking to enjoy their pregnancy. Rather our aim is to make sure that children who have been exposed to alcohol get the supports that they need, if they need supports. She's absolutely right that she has, in addition, although that she there was some alcohol exposure, your writer has some protective factors, including being generally healthy, getting good prenatal care, having good nutrition. And so those things are likely protective factors for her. But we do want the children who have not had those protective factors or who go on to have difficulties to have the supports that they need.
Okay. And this is a question that some listeners might not like, but I just want to establish this, because Kara, I think, obviously sounds like a great mom. She's really in tune with what's going on, and it sounds like her doctor is saying to her, you know, you're not in the group of people that I usually worry about. But still, my question is, it's still a non-zero chance that there's going to be an impact. Is that correct? Even light drinking, even half a glass once or twice a week, is there a non-zero chance there will be an impact that could manifest?
I really look at some of the molecular and biological studies that show a dose response curve, meaning that higher levels are going to have worse impact, but even fairly low levels could have an impact. It's just, there's no zero risk, just as you say. And so, I think it's important that women have the most accurate information, but I agree with Lynn that, you know, our goal is not to shame women or, you know, have people really worry about should I keep my baby or things like that. You know, I just really finding the right supports for people if they need them. And for people, as soon as if you do find out that you are pregnant and you have had drinks, the key is to stop as soon as you find out. And then just thinking about all that time that you haven't been drinking during pregnancy is how much you're protecting your child from any potential harm.
This can't be the first time you've heard questions or comments like this, though.
No, I hear it regularly.
Okay. No. Jenna in Pittsford is first up on the phones. Go ahead, Jenna. Are you there, Jenna?
These kinds of conversations. Yep, it's me.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yep.
Okay. These kinds of conversations infuriate me for a number of reasons. Lynn knows me personally. In fact, she and I have appeared on your show before regarding autism. My oldest son is on the spectrum and is also a patient at the Kerr Center. We've waited years to get an appointment with Dr. Hyman there. and for my pregnancy with him, I was not supposed to be able to get pregnant. So I did everything right. Didn't drink, ate all the right foods, non-GMO, all the happy nonsense they tell you to do to get pregnant the right way, because I wasn't supposed to be able to have a pregnancy. Did the same thing with my second pregnancy. Both of those children have some of the craziest medical conditions known to the doctors at Strong. And in fact, as Lynn may be aware, we're being referred out of the area to specialists to study my firstborn. My third child was unplanned but not unwanted. And as your emailer described, we were on vacation. I was enjoying myself, had many cocktails on this vacation, and came home and found myself pregnant and called my OB and said, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do? I was drinking. I'm pregnant. Now what? And he is my only completely healthy, completely typical, completely not allergic child. And I did nothing right. I ate peanut butter. I had alcohol. He's fine, happy, healthy, intelligent, perfect. And I think some of these studies scare women, shame women, scare human beings beyond all reality because we think we know everything. And the truth is, we can't live in a bubble because you can't predict. Some of these women in these studies are poor, they're impoverished, they're unhealthy, they're not eating the right foods, there may be lead poisoning. We don't know. We just don't know. And we're scaring women. Some women aren't having ultrasounds because they think they're unreasonable for a fetus. We have to stop shaming and scaring women out of pregnancy. It's just not right.
Jenna, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. And let's let our guests respond there. Lynn, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
So absolutely. I completely agree. We should not be shaming women, and we certainly don't want to be blaming women mm-hmm. for developmental difficulties that their child may have, whether or not they be, any kind of developmental disability. Families, especially mothers, take on a huge amount of guilt for all sorts of things that they have really had nothing, had no ability to control. Really what we're trying to do is to make sure that children aren't exposed to unnecessary risk. So just like women do things like avoid eating fish with high amounts of mercury or may avoid eating unpasteurized cheese to avoid infections during pregnancy, what we'd like mothers to do is to avoid alcohol because of the potential risk to the fetus. That being said, there are many children who have been exposed to alcohol prenatally who, like this caller says, go on to be perfectly developmentally fine, do quite well behaviorally and from a learning perspective. And that's part of what the research is working to understand is what are all of the factors that play together. So certainly alcohol is a factor, but this women who have other protective factors such as good nutrition, good prenatal care, other things like that are probably in some way protecting their baby or may have good protective genetics.
Okay, and I'll let the listeners know. I mean, I had a conversation with Christy Petrenko before the show, just kind of getting ready and talking about the very question on research and what we know and what we don't know, and I've never gotten the idea I take Jenna's point, but I've never gotten the idea that they're saying they do know everything. What I did think is interesting, though, is some of the research that we've seen, brain imaging, from what I can tell, and Christy will correct me if I'm reading this incorrectly, is that even parts of the very individual structures within the brain are impacted differently. So, mm-hmm. Sometimes we used to look for what I guess you call microcephaly or, smaller head and brain size, but it's not just a smaller brain size. It could be a misshapen or even parts of the brain individually impacted. Mm-hmm. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that is correct. So on average, children with FASD have smaller brains, particularly kids with the full fetal alcohol syndrome. And even when you take into account that kids have smaller brains, parts of the brain, such as the caudate, which is important for some motor functioning as well as some of those executive skills, parts of the frontal lobes that are also really important for the executive functioning, and other regions such as the corpus callosum, which is the band of axon fibers that connect the two hemispheres, have regions that are more affected than others. Overall, the shape of the brain is a bit more blunt in the front where the frontal lobes are and narrower in the parietal region, sort of on the side, which are very involved in visual spatial skills. And many of the changes we see in brain imaging studies are very consistent with some of the behavioral challenges. That being said, I want to emphasize, though, that we're not at the stage where a child can go get a brain scan and we can diagnose anyone with them. These are large group studies, and we're looking at when you compare kids with FASD versus typically developing children, subtle differences. There are some kids that will have clinical abnormalities on scans. Parts of the corpus callosum can be missing, for example, or part of the cerebellum can be pulled down in a Chiari malformation. But most of the children's brains are going to come out very clinically normal.
And we don't typically order any kind of brain imaging or MRI for children when we suspect a diagnosis. Yeah.
What is it then? What's the biggest piece of research or sort of a large sample size study that you'd love to see that if all the funding and resources were available at your fingertips, Christy Petrenko, that, you know, what's the biggest question that you don't know or want more information on?
My biggest interest, and what I think we really need to do, is get better at interventions. It wasn't until the last decade, really, that any research on interventions for FASD had been published. And we're talking something that we've known about for 40 years. And there are only a few researchers that are doing research on intervention, including myself. And I would really like to see a large study looking at how we can improve systems of care for FASD and improving access.
Can you talk a little bit more about what kind of interventions, you know, might be viable?
Yeah, there's an intervention study that we've just been doing, and it's in part a replication of a previous study done out in Washington State using a parent consultation program. And so we really work with parents in their homes generally and help them come up with effective behavior plans and understanding their children's behavior differently, as well as providing family support. Many of these parents, I don't care what kind of family structure they have, they're stressed and they have a high level of needs that they have to attend to. So, you know, these are families that are having to constantly prompt and remind their children. They have to do a lot more supervision. It's hard to find babysitters. It's hard to get respite. They're having to educate their children's teachers and mental health and medical providers about FASD to get care for them. And so they need a lot of support and respite and help with finding ways to do self-care so that they can be renewed and help with their children. I think also self-regulation and emotion regulation are important areas for intervention as well, which is what we're working on.
Okay. Jake writes to the program, says, given 1 in 13 women admit to having a drink when they were pregnant, 2% doesn't sound that high. As far as the spectrum goes, what's the breakdown of serious cases and what's the long-term prognosis for the milder cases?
So the full FAS prevalence estimates are 6 to 9 per 1,000, which represents about 25% of the full spectrum. And you see that in more of the kind of middle income countries.
And I'm sorry, Christy, can you kind of give me that number again so I can try to get my head
around
it? Yeah,
it's 6 to 9 out of 1,000. Have the full FAS. And then the broader spectrum is the 2 to 5%, which includes that. And you see a ratio of about 1 to 4 kids with FAS versus the broader spectrum in places like the U.S. and Italy that have more moderate drinking patterns. And in some regions, there's a region in South Africa that's been documented to have the highest rates of FAS. And they have a history of, in this one region, of paying their workers with alcohol. And so they have a really heavy binge drinking culture that is established. They no longer pay their workers with alcohol, but they have about a 1 to 1, about 50% FAS versus the rest of the spectrum.
Okay. Jake, I hope that answers your question. It's a good one. Lynn, what's out there for you that you still want answered? You know, in this ideal world of funding and resources, what do you want answered?
I agree that there's really much more need for intervention studies because it's, you know, not that helpful to be diagnosing kids if there's not really strong interventions in terms of what do we do about it. I think in addition to providing the types of supports that have been tested in the research through Mount Hope Family Center, there's really need for intervention studies looking at things like behavioral and mental health interventions, looking at medication. So many children struggle with symptoms of ADHD, but yet there's not specific research looking at what medications work and don't work for this group of kids. And finally, looking at the health complications associated with FASD. Many children struggle with things like sleep, with feeding, with ear infections. So knowing what are the health complications and how should they be treated similarly to children without or with FASD.
I also wanted to emphasize, too, that this is actually a lifelong condition. And so we really need a lot more knowledge as well as interventions and supports for our adolescents and adults. I think that's an area that is just now in the field people are starting to put a lot more emphasis on in terms of studies and research.
Is it harder to diagnose the older a child gets?
Yes.
I assume the answer to that is yes, but yes?
Yes. Absolutely. And for a number of reasons, the facial characteristics, the measurements we do tend to be more accurate in younger children. And when you go through adolescence, the structure of your face changes, which makes those measurements more difficult to do and may change the characteristics of the face. It also becomes more complicated as a child gets older because of normal teenage development and risk-taking and mental health conditions that may emerge during adolescence. So there's many more confounding factors as a child gets older.
A natural assumption would be that alcohol in the early stages of pregnancy would be more of a risk because the development is more sensitive and small. And I don't know if that's true. And we've had a few questions online about, are there more risky times to be drinking during pregnancy?
So we know the face forms about the third week or so after implantation. So that's probably like the fifth week after your two fake weeks of pregnancy. And the face forms during a very small amount of time. And so if you're drinking heavily during that time, you're likely to see the facial features. However, the brain is developing throughout your entire pregnancy and even up through early adulthood. So the impact of alcohol is could happen at any time, and particularly some later portions of pregnancy can be really impactful for brain functioning as well. So right. I've heard people tell
I'll
women,
wait to the third trimester.
That yeah, kind of and you can have a drink, and that's very inaccurate information, actually.
Okay. Another one of our listeners on Twitter, again, taking some sensitive issue with the comments about, what to tell women who are, sort of light drinkers. She said, literally every woman with healthy reproductive organs has the potential to become pregnant. Telling a woman to never drink is ridiculous. Again, what Christy Petrenko is saying is, if you are actively trying to become pregnant, don't drink. That's what you said. And she's saying that's over the top. But again, the medical community can't say you'll be, there's
no
consequence.
You'll be fine because we don't know that. You could have certain genetic factors, nutrition, other things, roll of the dice, and it could impact your child it could not. It's not just if you drink this amount, this will be your specific effect. There's so many other variables that go into outcomes.
Okay, and here is one more comment from a listener on Twitter. The fetus is more protected earlier in pregnancy, but the more we talk fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, insurance companies won't cover, just like autism spectrum disorder. Are we seeing insurance dealing with this? That's an interesting question.
No, we really haven't had difficulties with insurance excluding this diagnosis.
Okay.
My understanding of the mandates of the Affordable Care Act is that insurance companies are not able to exclude any diagnosis related to a prior diagnosis, or able to exclude coverage related to a prior diagnosis. So far, that has not been a challenge that our families have reported to us.
Okay. Same. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. And one more comment, an email that came in from a listener. PZ sends, in 1992, I attended a two-day short course given by the American Chemical Society pertaining to toxicology. One of the lecturers was a woman. I don't recall her name. She said, I have no concerns with a healthy pregnant woman having two drinks per day. I don't recall at what point in the pregnancy that the two drinks a day did not concern her. It's old information, to be sure, but not intended to be a license for pregnant women to be drinking, but it does suggest that a modest taste on occasion does not result in dire results. That comes from PZ. It doesn't sound like anybody's saying two drinks a day is advised here. You're Christy.
Oh, no. I would advise against
whoever said that, you're saying probably should never
have said that. That's old information or inaccurate at the time.
Okay. So thanks for the email there, PZ. All right. So we've tried to cover a lot of ground this hour with our guests, and we got about 90 seconds left here. So Lynn Cole, I'll start with you. What do you want to leave our listeners with on International Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day with the work that you're doing and what you want parents and our entire community to be thinking about?
I'd really like to leave families with an optimistic message. This is we work with this group of kids because we enjoy them. These kids have incredible strengths. Many of them have been through some really challenging times in their lives, and these kids and families are really wonderful. And with the right supports, these kids can be quite successful, and families can function very well.
Okay, Christy Petrenko.
And I agree. I mean, it is sometimes very difficult to hear all of the challenges that some of these kids have, but they have many, many strengths. And I think the key is just, as with anyone, finding that person's interests and strengths and really helping them find their niche so that they can feel meaning and purpose in their lives.
And real quick, I lied. One more quick question, because Eric says, please ask, are there common medications for this diagnosis? I would assume that depends on the symptoms. Is that...
Absolutely. So there are not specific medications to treat this diagnosis per se, but depending on a person's symptoms, there may be medications considered for those specific symptoms.
Well, there's only two clinics that we know of in the state. Christy Petrenko, do you expect that to grow in the future?
I would really hope it will. I think it takes a lot of real dedication and grassroots efforts, though, to make changes. And we're trying to do that across the state, but it's an uphill battle that we're going to keep working on.
Lynn?
Absolutely. We'll keep working.
Well, thanks to our guests for the hour joining us on International Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day. And I want to thank them for their time. Lynn Coles, the director of the Kirch Developmental Services Center, and Christy Petrenko, a research psychologist with the Mount Hope Family Center, very involved in not only the research, but also the question of intervention and treatment and solutions going forward. Thanks to you both for your time.
Thank you.
Short break, and we're talking the Fringe Festival next hour. Stay with us.